It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And many of you, I'm sure, have been watching the tamaracks as they fade from glory. I had them at their peak around the 10th of the month. And average date for peak of color for tamaracks is around the 15th. So a little early this year. And on that same vein, there was a sort of an abrupt end to the leaf season. I don't know why, but the leaves didn't linger this year, and they came down once they decided they were going to fall. Boy, it was like right now, everything was down. Save the willows. Now, if you're driving along looking at trees this morning, and you see some of those bushes that are sort of thatched with a little bit of yellow-green at the top, those are probably one or another species of willows. Could be Bebs or Discolor, or it could be the Shining Willows. All of them have this kind of thatch of leaves right at the very top that still remain. And the Weeping Willows, which are an introduced species to northern Minnesota, are still fairly green. And the crack willows and the peach-leaved willows and the black willows, these are all willow trees. All of them still have leaves and are changing gradually. The cottonwoods, which are a member of the willow family, but not exactly in the same genus or species, obviously, they are slowly losing their leaves. Now, the thing about cottonwoods is that they have these big, the scientific name is Populus deltoides, and deltoides refers to the kind of triangular shape of the leaf. But these leaves are, they turn yellow and then fall off the tree. But the leaves remaining are either a mixture of green and yellow. There's one on the river road that I pass twice a day, and it is still roughly 50% leafed. So watch for those trees that still have leaves, and most of them are either introduced, that is, brought to this area as decorative. In fact, as I look out the window here, I see that the river birch right outside the window by the library here are still pretty leafy. So most of the trees that still have leaves probably came from a different growing zone. They survive up here. They can tolerate the cold and get by, but they're not of this area naturally, which means that their timing is a little bit different, and usually it's a little bit recessed so that they're a little later with their leaf drop. So look for the willows, look for the tamaracks that are sort of fading fast toward their ratty orange feathery look, which is the new growth. When the tamarack puts out a new leader at the end of a branch, it, instead of having these little clusters of needles which grow up from a little unit called a fascicle, they get individual needles that are sort of opposite one another, and they go run down the long new growth. And those new growth segments and those needles that are on them last longer than the regular needles that are older, that are a year old or older. And those needles at the end of the new growth will hang on for quite a while before they sort of slide away. I saw my first snow buntings yesterday. Joel Rosen down in Mattawa saw his first snow buntings on the 14th. The average date for the first snow buntings is today, the 19th. So snow buntings were a day early, but that doesn't mean much. Now, snow buntings, pretty easy to pick them out. They're brownish-looking birds until they fly. And when they fly, you're going to see lots of white on the wings. When they're in their native habitat or their nuptial habitats, their breeding grounds, which is far north above the Arctic Circle, they are pure white. But by the time they get down here, they've faded to a kind of a brown and some spots of black here and there. Still, the overall effect of a snow bunting in flight is white. So if you see this bird that when it flies, and usually it's, yesterday I saw a pair and I saw a single. But normally I would see 15 or 20 in a group, and usually in fields or open country. And when they fly like that, what you're going to notice is flashes of white, and it will, and those are snow buntings. The other bird, the other winterish bird that I saw yesterday that was really kind of fun was a gray jay, and they just kind of, well, Bernd Heinrich described them once as flying with moth-like wings because they really are quiet and they just kind of glide in. Don't do a lot of flapping, don't do a lot of calling, but when they do call, it's a real clear, pure whistle and some odd little chuckles and notes. The interesting thing about gray jays, and Harry Hutchins talked about this a couple of years ago on the show, mentioned that they have really interesting saliva. And there's most of us, our saliva is kind of slick and slippery and designed to aid in swallowing food. Well, a gray jay's saliva is gooey and sticky and aids in sticking food to places where they like to hide it. So gray jays belong to the corvid family. The corvids are primarily cachers. When the food is good, corvids cache food. They hide it. And for ravens and crows, they might hide it for a day or a week or even a month and then come back and feast on it when times get thin. But for the gray jays, they hide their food with the idea that it's going to carry them through the winter. And so they remember a lot of hiding places over a long period of time. And they take this bits of food in their mouth and they coat it with their saliva and then they secrete it by gluing it to a tree somewhere or a little cranny or a nook someplace. And then they come back later and they remember where these caches are. And they come back later and they can peck them out and eat them. The preferred hiding places are above ground. They don't hide much on the ground because obviously when the snow falls, it's going to get kind of hard to recover some of those choice bits of food that they've hidden away. I talked a little bit about willows and the thatches that remain on some of the shrub willows, the bush willows that are growing in the swamps and so forth. Now is a good time to start looking into these swamps a little bit for what appear to be sort of large pussy willows. And what they are the catkins of the autumn willow. And the autumn willow has its, most of our willows have their pussy willows come out in March and in April. They sort of spread out and pollinate. And by May, you've got this little fluff floating around, and those are the seeds of the willow that get blown about and end up, landing here and there and creating new patches of willows. The autumn willow is just the opposite. Its catkins come out in the summer, and it goes through that whole stage in the fall, and this time of year, what you're seeing are these little cottony catkins, the female flowers, and those little bits of fluff will, over the winter, get blown away and perhaps start a new colony of autumn willows. And I really shouldn't use the word colony because they don't actually grow in clumps. You will be looking at a whole patch of willows, and you'll see, three or four different varieties of willows, but you'll see a single or maybe two or three autumn willows within that patch. And they're, as I said, easy to identify right now because of these fluffy little catkins that are kind of white and furry looking out there, and you can check those out. I did a little bit of a listing of the flowers that are still in bloom. And then on the 15th, the middle of the month, goat's beard, white campion, white sweet clover, red clover, oxeye daisies, dandelions, some species of aster, orange hawkweed, goldenrod, common tansy, yarrow, crown vetch, northern hawkweed, etc. There are a couple others. I don't think I mentioned dandelions, but there are still a few of those blooming out there as well. Mentioned earlier about the northern leopard frog that I saw hop up on the road, sit quietly on the blacktop, and probably warm up a little bit. It was headed towards Prairie Lake, and I think there are probably other frogs out there as well that are moving towards water. Now, you have green frogs, mink frogs, and northern leopard frogs that all hibernate or spend the winter under the ice in water, usually not too deep. They take in oxygen through their skin, and survive that way. But then you have the wood frogs, the spring peepers, the boreal chorus frogs, and the gray tree frogs. Those four frogs that will now be sort of looking for resting spots in the leaf litter in the forest, and will spend the winter frozen and come back. Speaking of frozen, the morning cloak, I saw a morning cloak butterfly this past week, and that's another one that freezes and then comes out in the spring. And finally today, last note this week, the common asparagus. Boy, if you want to have fresh asparagus in the spring, now is the best time to find the plants, because they are flaming orange yellow right now. The whole plant is flaming orange yellow, and some of those plants still have these bright red berries on them. So check for common asparagus. You'll find plants where you never thought they'd be, but they're really easy to see. They're very, I don't want to say spindly, kind of filmy, sort of insubstantial, but tall, 3, 4, 5 feet tall, and bright yellow orange right now. So mark your common asparagus, put a little flag in the ground there, and next spring, when things start to warm up a little bit, come back and you will have lovely fresh asparagus captured in the wild and enjoyed on your plate. That's the Phenology Show for today. As always, I thank you for listening, and remember, this is our pledge week, so please call and support community-supported KAXE Radio.
You're listening to Phenology Plus on 91.7 KAXE, Northern Community Radio, service made possible by our listener members, and those numbers to call to become a member of KAXE, 326-1234, that's our local line. Our toll-free number is 1-800-662-5799. Coming up, listener letters and comments on Talkback with John. Deep Portage Learning Center is located on 6,100 acres of forest land in Cass County between Hackensack and Longville. The center offers a variety of outdoor activities and classes for all ages. Deep Portage also has over 18 miles of hiking and ski trails, an interpretive center, and educational programs open to the public year-round online at deep-portage.org. The moose population in northwest Minnesota has crashed, and wildlife biologists aren't sure why. The number of moose in northeastern Minnesota is stable but threatened, and anytime you see a moose, you can help with the research by reporting the time and place of your sighting. There's a link to the University of Minnesota and DNR's research site, and that's at our website, kaxe.org. The Minnesota Women's Woodland Network is a new program intended to help women learn about trees, nature, and caring for the land. It's an informal learning environment that is conversational by nature. Minnesota author Gayla Marty will be in Grand Rapids Tuesday, November 16th from 6:30 to 8 in the evening to talk about her book, Memory of Trees, A Daughter's Story of a Family Farm. That event is being held at the University of Minnesota's North Central Research and Outreach Center in Grand Rapids. There's no cost for the program, but they'd like you to register ahead of time. Call KAXE for more information. 326-1234, toll-free 800-662-5799. Those are the numbers. We'd like you to call and pledge your support to this unique, independent community radio service, KAXE, authentic local radio for northern Minnesota since 1976. For the last 34 and a half years, our largest source of funding has been our listener members. And every fall, we have a fall membership drive. This fall's membership theme is There's Nothing to Be Scared Of. And we hope you'll take a moment out of your evening to call and support Phenology Plus and all the other great programs and music you hear on KAXE. That's how important your pledge is. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by Friday night, and your pledge will help us get there right now. We have a couple of nice gifts to pass on to you for your pledge right now to the program during Phenology Plus. Jeff Penix, a fine woodworker and a forester, has made bluebird houses for us out of cedar. And we have three of these bluebird houses. We'd be glad to give you one of those for a pledge at the $10 a month level or more. And we also have a reissue of the classic Raven Phenology t-shirt. That's also available for a pledge at the $10 a month level or more. If you'd like a Bluebird House and the t-shirt, $20 a month will work for you. Give us a call, make that pledge, and we'll be glad to give you one of these gifts or both. 326-1234 or toll free 800-662-5799.
It's time for TalkBack. TalkBack is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've got a pledge you'd like to support the radio station with. Maybe you've got an observation you'd like to share, a comment you'd like to make, or just a question you'd like to pose. It really doesn't matter. Give us a call and let us know. You can also reach us by email. My email address is jlatimer@kaxe.org. And you can reach the radio station at comments@kaxe.org. And you can always, always write to us. Our address is 260 Northeast 2nd Street, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, 55744. We will be happy to hear from you. And we did hear from a bunch of you this week, including our good friend Joel down in Mattawa. And Joel said that he saw his first snow buntings in the area on the 14th. He thought that the tamaracks had moved past their peak of color and were kind of fading. And he said that the crows have begun to migrate. He also mentioned that he was still harvesting a few tomatoes out of his greenhouse. And I have to tell you, we have tomatoes at our house. We had three big tomato plants growing in pots, and we moved them into the screen porch. And they're doing real well, and we're having fresh tomatoes yet off the vine here in the last couple of days. So we, as well as Joel, are enjoying some tomatoes. We heard this week from Mrs. Grabarkowitz's fourth grade class at the Cohasset School, and they said that the leaves have finished turning color and are falling. Ducks are migrating, and many of the young hunters in that class are excited to end that journey early for some of the lucky ducks. Emma's horses are searching for grass to eat. Aria said that the pumpkins are ripe. Jessica said the mornings are way cold, and Sarah is digging out hats and mittens. Alden notes that the tamaracks are turning yellow, and Haley noticed that there is more frost in the mornings. That from Mrs. Grabarkowitz's fourth grade class in Cohasset. And we heard also, it's kind of a week for new connections, and this week we heard from Mrs. Dallas, fourth grade class in the Pine River Bacchus Elementary School in the Pine River, in the town of Pine River. And they are noting the golden tamaracks. On the 11th, Amber noticed that the squirrels were leaving piles of pine cones under the trees. On Tuesday, Olivia saw a strange beetle on a pumpkin. And there are a lot of beetles out there that are moving around right now, and perhaps you're seeing some. The Asian ladybugs are out in force, and there are other beetles out as well. Still a lot of insects moving about with these warm October days. On Saturday the 16th, Ryan saw more spiders in her house, and you know, I don't know that spiders move indoors. I think that spiders either are indoors or they're outdoors. I did a little searching last night in Larry Weber's book, Spiders of the North Woods, and I couldn't find anything that said that spiders actually sort of migrate indoors. Perhaps as the weather cools, we're just spending a little more time indoors and are seeing more spiders that have been dining on all those critters in our houses all summer long. Emma, Autumn, and Analia saw swans this past week, and also that was on Saturday, and also over the weekend, Emma saw two bald eagles. On Sunday, Chelsea saw a dead skunk, and Chelsea wondered, when do they tend to move around the most? And Chelsea, I think that, you know, this time of year, the skunks are, they're starting to search out places where they can spend the winter. They spent the summer, a lot of the young ones spent the summer being tended by their mothers. And now they're sort of getting separated from their mothers, and they're going about looking for places to spend the winter. And they don't hibernate in the traditional sense of hibernation, but they do get fat, and they do sleep for long periods of time, which I suppose meets some of the definitions of hibernation. But they are doing a lot of looking for the right spot to spend the winter. And that's, so I would say late summer and into fall probably are the greatest times of motion for skunks, greatest time of travel. On the 17th, Jessica heard howling near her home. She wasn't sure what it might have been. I suppose it could have been a wolf, could have been a coyote, it might have been a neighbor dog, it could have been a cat. Lots of opportunities there for howling. Shana and Karina noted that the tamaracks are becoming golden, and Jaden tried to count the tamarack trees on a trip to his grandma's house. There were too many, but he did note that it was easy to spot them because of their bright color this time of year, and I like that idea. I like the idea that you could try to count them, but maybe not be able to count that many, but they sure are easy to pick out right now. Jaden and Olivia have been seeing many flocks of geese, and Deanna saw a deer in her front yard. Damien saw a red fox as he headed to the bus. And finally, the class noted that the sun is coming up later and going down earlier. And that is the case for sure. We had a phone call this week from our friend Dick, who called with this note.
This is October 11th, and I just heard a loon call up in the north end of Lower Balsam Lake. And it must be a young one that's a little laggardly on heading south, because they're supposed to be out of here in September, by the end of September. But with the warm weather, I guess he's hanging out. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dick. You know, when we were last weekend, or last week, you may recall, the show came from the duck blind, and there were lots and lots of loons on Leech Lake, hundreds. And most of them are juveniles. The adults have moved on, and a lot of the juveniles are still hanging around. I saw a loon yesterday on Wabana. Sometimes, you know, some of them, these are juvenile loons, and some of them, you know, if the mother and father had a failed nest the first time, for example, they might re-nest, which might put the juevenile loon 2, 3, 4 weeks behind other loons, and so they just might not be quite ready to make the flight yet. So, Dick, I appreciate the note. Lower Balsam, that's not a real big lake. A lot of the bigger lakes will have big flocks of loons on them well into November, even as ice begins to form. They'll prolong their visit up here before they head to the ocean for the winter. Ed Dallas called this morning. He said on the 12th, he saw a leopard frog sitting on the road, and I recounted an event that I had where I had a leopard frog on, I think it was Wednesday this past week, a week ago tomorrow, hopped out of the ditch and onto the road and then sat there. And it hopped out in front of me, and I kind of swerved so I wouldn't hit it. And it's a place where I turn around and go back. So I turned around and I went back past it and very slowly pulled up next to it and looked out the window to make sure that it was in fact a leopard frog and that I hadn't hit it. And I looked down at it and he was just sitting there comfortably on the road. And I suspect that the road was nice and warm. And once he got to the road, he was like, oh, this feels good. I'm going to just stay here for a while. Eventually, I suspect that it probably completed its journey. It was headed toward Prairie Lake. And I suspect that it's probably in Prairie Lake even as we speak. Ed noted lots of meadowhawk dragonflies, those little red guys. You should check those out. They'll be out almost into November, so watch for meadowhawk dragonflies. He said there are fewer and fewer snakes on the roads. And then his short list of flowers still in bloom included one lupin, a prairie coneflower, black-eyed Susans, chickweed, south thistle, red clover. And Ed had the following note about buckthorn. Buckthorn is an invasive shrub, almost a tree. And it is one of those trees that you don't want to have around. If you find buckthorn on your property, you want to cut them down and get rid of them. And now is an easy time to find the buckthorn because they are still full of bright green leaves. And I can see them out the studio windows on later in the day when the light is better. I'll be able to see buckthorn growing here along the Mississippi River. So if you have a shrub in your yard right now that has bright green leaves on it, looks pretty healthy and not like it's getting ready for fall at all, check and see if there aren't some thorny projections on the thing and maybe some black fruit. And if that's the case, it's probably buckthorn and you'd be well advised to eradicate it from your yard. Our final note this week comes from Mr. Holmes' fifth grade class at Roosevelt Elementary School in Virginia. Talk about longtime supporters of KAXC. That's a group that's been with us for a long time, and we always appreciate their notes.
The kids on bus 15 report that geese are still seen flying south in the mornings over the Laurentian Divide. Michaela has seen some V formations and some in straight lines. In the school forest, the orange tamarack needles are beginning to fall to the ground. Skylar reports finding a squirrel's nuts hidden in her yard. She counted about 20 hazelnuts covered with a thin layer of soil and leaves. She left them for the squirrel to eat in the winter if he can find them. Jonas reports that Raven was eating Kix breakfast cereal on the side of the road one day last week near Mintac. There is another raven that sits on the top of the silver maple tree outside of our classroom. The leaves have dropped off the maple, and there are so many leaves that the homeowner runs over them with his lawnmower instead of raking them up. Chloe has a stray cat living under her deck, and she wonders what she should do about it now that the weather is turning colder. Jackson went grouse hunting last weekend and got 0 grouse and 3 red squirrels. There was a bat Bo's house the other day. Bo's dad hit it with a tennis racket because he didn't like the looks of it. My class collected plant and flower samples in the school forest spruce bog last week. We also found wintergreen, Labrador tea, creeping snowberry, starflower, and sphagnum moss. There are still ring-billed gulls flying around Silver Lake at the landfill outside of town. They sound like this. That is our report for this week. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bill, you did a real nice job. That was Bill, by the way, and a real nice job, as always, from Mr. Holmes' fifth grade class at the Roosevelt Elementary School. A couple of notes there that were kind of interesting. The stray cat, you know, you see cats that have lost part of their ears because of frostbite and... And I guess if you could capture the cat, you could turn it over to the animal control people. But cats can be a problem, and having them loose in the landscape isn't a good thing for the birds. So I don't know what else to tell you about that. I did enjoy the note about the ring-billed gulls. There are a few of those around, and they will be... they'll hang outside. You know, sometimes I think because of fast food restaurants, ring-billed gulls actually stay all winter, but I'm sure that they probably migrate a short distance and then come back early in the spring. So we'll be watching the ring-billed gulls, among others. That's our talkback show for today. Thank you for tuning in. As always, we encourage you to call us with your observations, your questions, and your comments. And don't forget... to call us with your pledge, 326-1234 or 1-800-662-5799. Call and pledge your support to community-supported radio.
The late Gil Quall hunted, fished, and gathered wild foods in and around the Chippewa National Forest. And for many years, Gil did wild food programs on KAXE. This evening, we have an essay Gil recorded about one of those late fall edible foods that he looked for this time of year, wild grapes.
The habitat of grapes is greatly restricted in these northern latitudes, yet there are places where the vines have established themselves and they yield an abundant and flavorful fruit. In addition to sunlight, proper soils, and moisture, they require a growing season slightly longer than normal for this area. Thus, if one is interested in searching out wild vineyards, he must focus upon areas whose temperatures are mollified by their surroundings. Large bodies of water and rushing rivers will delay frost, thus islands, peninsulas, and gorges are possible sites for the wild grape. September is a good month to gather grapes, especially during the last half. The fruit is mature and easily spotted after the leaves have fallen. The plant grows to a monstrous size, with many ramifications of twig and tendril. The vine complex literally blankets the earth, superimposing its contours on brush, branch, and tree. In places where its only support is its own interwoven limbs, it looks like an ocean wave about to lose its crest. Beneath, in pendant clusters, hang the grapes, begging to be plucked. The grape, in various locations, is black, blue, or purple in color, while its surface is either frosted or shiny. The cluster may either be a plump, tight grouping or a loose, open one. With diameters ranging from a quarter to 5/8 of an inch and membership in a group varying from 10 to 50, it becomes obvious that the berry by itself does not provide a means of identification. The leaves, alas, are gone, but from the remnants it can be inferred that they were simple, broad, serrated, and maple-like, suitable for making grapes or providing motifs to grace the sides of Grecian urns. However, the vine persists as a shaggy, tough perennial, and its tendrils are fine, curly, and often show a split hair ending. When mature, the vine has a diameter of more than an inch and remains unbranched for several feet, although often bowed and twisted. Grapevines have no spurs or thorns. In this area, other purple-fruited vines include the poisonous woodbine and the poisonous moonseed, but neither vines nor leaves resemble those of the grape. When all identification is positive, the final test to be made is that of taste. The grape's flavor is like that of a Concord grape, but a little more intense. One can gather vignettes as well as grapes from the vine. Once, while vainly trying to grasp a lofty cluster, I was shaken to my bootstraps by a raucous caw overhead, so close and so loud, it seemed that the bird on the canopy above had no knowledge of the human below. Was he feeding on grapes? I wondered, but never found out, for unseen by me, he flew to parts unknown. He left unsighted, but the imagery remained, a strange, unnatural scenario, shrouded by a vividness that begged for an explanation. Months later, it dawned on me. Vignettes, like vintage, must bide their time. They must ferment within the watersheds of each private conscience until they mature. With me, the setting mood and voice from above made the moment indelible. There was no lesson to be learned, no moral imparted, just an imprint etched in my consciousness that will always color my grape gathering. To me, the Aesopian ambience of that moment is as memorable as any draught of any wild brew concocted by man or nature. Grapes make an excellent juice and a superb jelly. They make a fine wine, and some will claim that there's none better. Whatever its merits, there's one sobering thought to be retained in your mind. You will never know unless you search out the cloistered covert of the wild grape.
The late Gil Quall. We hear Gil's essays from time to time on Phenology Plus. And if you'd like a CD of some of Gil's wild food essays, give us a call, make a pledge at $10 a month or more. We'll send you a CD of Gil's essays, plus that reissue of the classic Raven Phenology t-shirt. 326-1234, toll free 800-662-5799. Molly Hoffman's a birder who lives in the Grand Marais area on the north shore of Lake Superior. And this evening, Molly tells Jay Anderson from WTIP Radio in Grand Marais about some of her rare and unusual bird sightings along the north shore. Here's Molly with Jay Anderson.
So I'm thinking of one experience in particular to start with, and you had a number of years ago and put your detecting skills to a real test. That visitor was probably from Europe.
Yeah, it was a very strange bird, and we got a call from Hovland from Gail Johan, and she's a wildlife photographer. And so she called up and she said that she had a weird bird there, and she described it to us, and we were both blanking completely. We went up there, and when we saw the bird, I just about fell over. We had, before we went up there, checked out some European books just in case, and sure enough, it was a European bird, and it's related to our chickadee. It looks like a giant chickadee with a yellow breast, with a black mark sort of bisecting that yellow breast. And otherwise, the head really looks like a chickadee. And it's called a great tit. And tit is a family of birds which includes all the chickadees and the titmice and stuff like that. And in Europe, that's what they call all of their chickadees. And we got to see it, and I got to record it. So it was really a thrill. And it is very unusual. When I reported it to birders, though, it's like, oh, well, if they can't count it for their list, they don't want to count it. And so it's like, hey, this is the most spectacular bird we've seen, and nobody really cares.
Well, they're pretty sociable. I read some material you gave me on them, and they seem to be a pretty sociable bird, just like chickadees are.
In Europe, they're yard birds. People put up houses for them, and they come to feeders, and their range is huge. So they also exist in boreal forests. They range from Europe all the way across to Asia.
Well, you were met with some skepticism and a lot of kind of false starts, as I understand it. Where did your detecting lead you?
Well, the skepticism was because you can't count a bird on your list. We don't keep a list, okay? So that sort of gets us out of that. But you can't count a bird on your list, say, as a Minnesota bird, unless you can prove that it's a wild bird, okay? We know this is not from here, but is it a vagrant? In other words, a vagrant would be something that made its way over here without human assistance. Or is it a released bird, from a cage bird? And the birders just said to me, well, it's commonly kept as a cage bird.
Now, you found that wasn't exactly true.
Well, not exactly. I started with the Duluth Zoo, and I started talking to all the pet shops in Thunder Bay and Duluth. I went all the way to the cities and started this range of calling pet shops. And it was a difficult thing to do. A lot of people didn't know what it was, and the people that did know what it was simply said it was not kept at a cage as a cage bird. And I went on to look at New York. I looked at the East Coast. I looked at the West Coast in California, again, looking for where are these kept as cage birds. And again, basically, I was finding it's extremely rare. I'm in that research mode again. Actually, I'm contacting the USDA, their import-export people. And there's only 4 ports where you can bring birds in. And I did a data. Well, like it's like a Data Practices Act, Freedom of Information Act, to see if I can't get how many the last decade came in. And I'll be very interested to see that number.
Well, we're assuming.
Where else can it come? Well, you asked that question. Siberia. They would be the white-breasted kind, though.
Yeah.
Or there are records in Greenland. Sometimes birds come that way.
Now, what are some other interesting bird sightings that we've had in this area?
The next sort of most odd bird is another European one. And it's called a field fare, and that was in 1991 near the Devil Track River. And people came up from all over North America to see this bird. And that's definitely a vagrant. Things like rock ptarmigan, no records in Minnesota until 1996, right out on Artist Point. What's kind of cute is things happened right in the city of Grand Marais. Peggy Heston called me up. She had taken, this is October, she had taken her feeder down, hummingbird feeder. But the neighbor had gone to the hospital, left her feeder up, and Peggy called me up. She said, Molly, I know this bird is bigger than a ruby-throated hummingbird, and she watches birds. So I like, okay. It turned out to be an Annis hummingbird, first state record. Got a call from the Blombergs, and their son, Lyndon, at 3.5 years old, had alerted them to a very odd bird in a tree outside their house. They took video of it. We went and talked to. It was really fun because Lyndon was so excited, but he could describe it. That became a wood stork, first state record. You know, people in town like Flossie and Dave Palmer had a golden crown sparrow, very, very unusual. There's Blue Grosbeak Penny and Bruce Brisson. They've had so many neat birds at their feeder. We went there to see a summer tanager they had coming to their feeder, and there was a blue grosbeak also. So it's really cool. Grand Marais and Lake Superior and the whole situation up here do attract a lot. And the list of birds you can see that I have is really long. You could go on and on. Ken and I have always looked for birds, and I know we looked out the harbor and we saw what looked like, we thought in our imagination, in our books, an ancient murrelet bobbing around in the middle of the harbor. And we went from one side to the other, from one breakwater to the other breakwater, and tried to get closer, you know, had a scope and everything. We really couldn't see it closely until it finally floated in, and it turned out to be a plastic bag. But recently, an ancient murrelet did show up and actually floated past the harbor mouth and was observed by a couple of birders and documented.
Molly Hoffman with Jay Anderson. Our thanks to community radio station WTIP in Grand Marais for sharing that segment with us with Molly Hoffman. You're listening to Phenology Plus on 91.7 KAXE, authentic local radio for northern Minnesota.